Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Dear listener, Sai Ram, Professor Venkatraman is back and ready with his talks on awareness and the Gita, and we are pleased to resume from where we left off. Today, Professor Venkatraman would present his ninth talk on awareness. What is his topic? Well, let us listen and find out. Over now to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. I am sorry the series got interrupted and that I had to miss a few talks in both the awareness series and the companion Gita Musing series. I am sure you know the reason why. Anyway, now that I am back in station, let me do the best I can to pick up where I left off. As announced, today's talk would form a part of the awareness series. In view of the unintended break, maybe I should use this talk for a detailed review of what I said in my previous 8 talks in the awareness series. You may recall that I started by reminding you that awareness means being conscious of the omnipresence of God and adjusting one's actions in all their aspects to be in tune with this reality, namely that God is present everywhere. The idea that God is present everywhere might seem a bit odd to many, especially when one is focused very strongly on the human form of God, namely the avatar. This is a wrong notion, and to dispel this, I pointed out the following. 1. The individual is the microcosm, while society is the macrocosm. Since divinity is latent in the individual, and this is something that Swami has been telling us again and again, since divinity is latent in the individual, divinity is latent also in society, on a macro scale in fact. If the individual does not allow his or her divinity to manifest, then there is a slim chance of a macro manifestation of divinity in society. 4. And if divinity is prevented by individuals from having its full play in society, then society would be in all kinds of trouble, as in fact it presently is. So those are the 4 points I made earlier in connection with the omnipresence of God. So you see, whether we like it or not, practical spirituality has everything to do not only with the individual, but also the relationship of the individual to society and to nature. It is to stress this important fact that Swami often tells his students that we are what we are because of society, and that we therefore owe a lot to society, indeed much more than what we think society owes to us. This is what I pointed out after my general introduction when I began the series. Now, since God is present in everything, everywhere, all the time, almost all our actions acquire a spiritual undertone. In fact, stressing this, Swami once told me, everything is spiritual, be careful. In the old days, Swami used to describe a man who owned a bullock cart. This man was very cruel in treating the bull, and yet when he visited the local Shiva temple, this very same man would worship reverentially the idol of Nandi located at the entrance of the temple. Nandi, whose idol always adorns the entrance of every Shiva temple, is the bull that serves as Shiva's vehicle. Swami says, is it not an irony that this man worships a stone idol of the bull, but is very cruel to the living bull that he owns? That is the type of contradiction that creeps into the life of practically every person who claims to be a devotee of God in general and Swami in particular, but ignores the omnipresence of God. And this contradiction manifests because the person concerned simply refuses to come to terms with the omnipresence of God. You might recall that I went into great details concerning this using a concept called the golden triangle. Okay, now the question is, how come we become so insensitive to the obvious? That explained is related to our gunas, which grow from our natural tendencies shaped in earlier births. These latent tendencies encoded in earlier births are called vasanas, and they form the seed for the gunas one sees in the present life of the person concerned. Gunas will develop partly controlled by latent vasanas and partly influenced by the environment in which a person lives. However, a person can, with determination of course, actually shape and modify his guna pattern so as to help him advance spiritually. The whole issue of developing complete awareness boils down then to the following. 1. Man must be aware of his cosmic origin. 2. Man must be aware of his cosmic connection. He does not simply exist in isolation, free to do what he wants, the way he wants and when he wants. Not true. Krishna makes that very clear, and Swami has added clarifications relevant to this day and age. All this I have pointed out. 3. Becoming aware of one's cosmic connection brings with it cosmic responsibilities. In practical terms, one cannot act in ways that harm society and or nature. 4. Finally, man must be aware of his cosmic destiny, which is that life is a blessing given so that man can become permanently reunited with his creator. So, there are these 4 cosmic aspects to human life. Cosmic origin, cosmic connection, cosmic responsibilities, and cosmic destiny. As Swami says, the purpose of life is to go back where we came from. From God we have come, and to God we must return. That really is the goal of life, and no one is exempted. Repeat, no one. Okay, let's say that we have become aware that cosmic omnipresence pervades the whole of creation. What next? I pointed out that this cosmic omnipresence actually pervades the universe at 3 distinct levels. The first level is the gross, the second is the subtle, and beyond them both is the causal. To put it differently, God is present in atoms as atomic energy that physicists have studied with such thoroughness. All of us know that atoms are present everywhere in the universe, which means God is certainly omnipresent at the gross level. Next, cosmic energy operates in living systems as a mysterious life force that we call prana. Scientists can describe life forces in terms of biochemistry and all that, but none of them can say where this life force comes from. That is because they do science shutting their eyes to God. To be perfectly accurate and fair, I must mention that careful scientists say, look, science works within the framework of space and time alone and excludes everything else, including consciousness. However, while as scientists we say nothing about God, as human beings we do believe in God at the theological level. That's what the careful scientists say. Now, there is also a higher and a third level of omnipresence, very important I might add, at which God is present in human beings. I told you that this level of presence of the divine is unique to humans, which is why Swami reminds us repeatedly that human birth is a priceless gift. This third and very subtle level is the level of consciousness. Human consciousness itself has many strata or layers. At the lower end, it makes one conscious of beauty, for example. Thus it is that you and I are able to enjoy the sight of a beautiful sunset, whereas a tiger or a crow would not be. At a slightly higher level, human consciousness awakens us to the sufferings of others and reach out to them with help. At a still higher level, we are able to cognize that there exists a God whose children we all are and from whom came everything. Rising up one notch further, we become aware that God actually resides in our heart and is ever ready to speak to us as well as advisors is the voice of conscience. Of course, for this to happen, we must keep the communication channel in good working condition, which is to say that our buddhi ought to be in top form. And when one rises to this level, it is one short step, but a difficult one, I must warn you. It is one short step to realize that the same God dwells in all beings and indeed in all entities in creation, both animate and inanimate. Once you grant that consciousness pervades the entire universe and is also the source of all feelings as well as of all energy, both animate and inanimate, we just cannot afford to ignore it. Rather, we had better be constantly aware of it and tune our actions accordingly. And to help this, I stated two rules, and let me recall them once more. Rule 1, act in the transient world, but according to eternal guidelines and in harmony with the permanent basis of creation. Rule 2, see the universe in the particular and the particular in the universal. Let me summarize all that I have said thus far, both in this talk and in earlier ones, in a slightly different set of words. 1. I started by stating that I am trying to discuss the omnipresence of God. 2. This omnipresence of God I am talking of is the abstract, formless God. 3. In the manifested universe, God is present in three distinct aspects. 4. Firstly, God is present as the power immanent in the atom. Since atoms are to be found everywhere in the universe, God too is immanent everywhere in the manifested universe. 5. Scientists may be able to give a physical explanation for the presence of energy in the atom. But according to me, the question remains, where did that energy originally come from? This is where Gandhi's observation about an indefinable mysterious power pervading the universe becomes very pertinent. 6. The omnipresence that I just mentioned is common to inert as well as to living beings. In living beings, God is present or immanent at a still higher level also, that of prana or the life force. 7. There is a still higher level, which is the level of pure consciousness. This is present in an active form in humans. It is this that enables humans to see God, if they want, that is, both within and without. 8. Pure consciousness is supreme, which means it can exist all by itself. Stated differently, when the universe disappears, it dissolves into pure consciousness, as Krishna explained to Arjuna. 9. One should not imagine that when the universe is created, the primordial background of universal consciousness disappears. The latter continues to exist, acting as a backdrop in the manifested universe. 10. I hold that this backdrop acts rather like a physical field, driving the evolution of living species in the direction where consciousness flowers fully, like a fruit bud growing and ripening into a sweet fruit. 11. Where the evolution of life is concerned, that fruit is the human being. It's a long list. Supposing one grants all this, what is the bottom line? According to me, the bottom line is the following. Man must be aware that he is a spark of the divine, and that this divine is omnipresent in the manifested universe, in every single entity, both animate and inanimate, in many different forms. This subtle and universal presence of the Lord is not very obvious at first sight, which is why we often lose sight of Him. However, we should not, and we must ensure that every single act of ours does not cause harm to our spiritual progress, does not harm society, and finally, does not either contradict or disturb nature in any way. That is the bottom line as far as I am concerned. If we do this regularly, meticulously and consciously, keeping God in our mind all the time, then we are in fact adhering to Mama Dharma, the theme of my Gita series, the series that is being broadcast as a companion to the present one. Well, the question is often asked, if God is actually within everyone all the time, how come man so easily forgets God? Well, this is an old question, and the short answer to this is that man forgets God all because of the gunas. You see, gunas, if not properly shaped and managed, can easily lead us astray, especially in today's world, so full of distractions meant to deliberately trap us in self-indulgence and sensuous living. If we must avoid the hazards, we must pay attention to the warning signals that come from the voice of conscience. As I told you earlier, our conscience is the voice of God speaking from within. Being soft, this voice can be easily drowned. It can be drowned out by the constant chatter of the mind. In turn, this means that one who wants to hear God speaking from within had better learn to A. keep his mouth shut most of the time, and B. extend that by training his mind to dwell on God most of the time. That in turn means we must keep the pipeline called buddhi in top condition. Once buddhi is sparkling clean and ready for business, then we can dial the conscience anytime. This is the first step, becoming aware of the presence of God within and learning to consult God on all matters relating to satya and dharma. I now wish to say something about consciousness, since that is very crucial where humans are concerned. You might recall that in one of my earlier talks I used two terms, individual conscience and universal consciousness. Maybe I should redefine these terms for your benefit. What exactly are these and what's the connection between them, if any? Once we understand this, the question of what awareness is all about would become immediately clear. Individual conscience is an aspect of God specific to individuals and acting as an internal as well as a personal advisor. Where did this conscience come from? Of course, from universal consciousness. Well, there are billions of individuals on earth and each one has his or her own individual conscience. However, this does not mean that each person has a distinct conscience that has no connection with that of others. Krishna makes that very clear and he says there is only one universal consciousness and that a bit of this functions in each individual to guide that one particular individual. Once an individual realizes that all the so-called different consciences, your conscience, my conscience, his conscience, her conscience, etc., are really parts of one universal whole, then one's perspective of creation changes completely, and I mean really completely. Okay, so we agree that conscience is present in different individuals. It may appear individual specific, but it is all part of one universal consciousness from which our universe, in fact, and everything in it came into existence. We agree to all this. Actually, realizing this is what awareness is all about. In other words, individual conscience and universal consciousness are one and synonymous with God. Prajnanam Brahma. They pervade everything all the time. However, while individual consciousness has meaning only when there is diversity, that is to say after creation, universal consciousness or Brahman exists all by itself even when creation is dissolved. To put it differently, individual consciousness is the micro aspect, while universal consciousness is the macro aspect, the source of which is beyond space and time. Of course, when there is no creation, there is no space, no time, and there is only absolute oneness. That is the ultimate, if you like. I am sure you are wondering whether this thing that I am referring to as the ultimate universal consciousness is the same as Atma. Indeed it is, and that is precisely what the Upanishads also declare. A few more points and I am done for the day. The question is often asked, is there a God in a murderer? If so, why does he commit murder? A related question, if God is omnipresent, why is there so much evil? In a sense, I have already dealt with this issue. Basically, it's all about being disconnected with the heart. That is why cruel people are often described as heartless. I think it might help if I offer a summary again. One, God being eternal exists both when there is a universe and when there is no universe. Two, when there is no creation, God exists in the form of pure abstract oneness. This abstract oneness is not easy for us humans to describe, bound as we are by the experience of space and time. But sages have recognized this supreme state of existence through their meditations, and Krishna has confirmed God existing as unmanifest divinity. 3. When God creates the universe, it's not as if he disappears from the state of unmanifest existence to come down to the universe and hide himself there in various forms and aspects. Actually, God now exists at two states or two levels, that of unmanifest divinity as usual and as the God immanent in every entity in creation. So God is there, God is here, God is everywhere, God is beyond also. 4. I then pointed out that in creation, God is present everywhere in gross matter as the energy of atoms. 5. In living beings, God is present as an extra aspect, that of the divine life force or prana. 6. In human beings, he is present in a still higher aspect as the conscience. Okay, all this is fine, but why? What exactly is the meaning of a person being disconnected with his heart? Well, you see, that happens when buddhi gets clogged and the mind becomes entirely subservient to the senses. Obviously, this is also related to discrimination becoming totally blunted, spiritual discrimination that is. So, two things happen. Buddhi becomes choked, pipeline is clogged, mind is not able to connect to the heart, it is connected only to the senses, and senses make the mind the slave. And at that stage, discrimination is gone fut. You might recall that I discussed the issue of the mind in one of my talks. I pointed out then that to start with, what we call the mind is really a continuum, extending from the lower mind at one end to the higher mind at the other, with the middle mind tucked in between. The lower mind performs essentially the functions we normally associate with the sense-brain combination. To be explicit, the senses collect information from the outside world and transmit it to the brain. There, in the brain, the information is processed and action to be taken by the body is determined by the brain. And depending on the decision of the brain, signals then go to the senses and the limbs of the body to guide the body in its action. I also pointed out that this kind of hardwiring is present in animals also, and God has built this in for reasons of survival. Since we have evolved from animals, it's not surprising that these functions are present in humans also. In passing, I pointed out that this conclusion, which is based on the findings of modern science, is also what Vedanta describes. Only Vedanta uses a different jargon. Moving beyond the lower mind, I then took you into the realm of the middle mind, which is the home of immense creativity. The middle mind, no doubt, is very fertile, but it's also capable of trapping man into ego, which is the slippery slope connecting to disaster. God has not hardwired the middle mind, but left it free to either function independently or be guided by the higher mind. Naturally, man is responsible for the choice he makes. At this point, I pointed out that humans inherit three distinct kinds of genes: biogenes from their parents and bodily ancestors, mental genes from earlier births, please note that one cannot blame the mental genes on ancestors, and finally, divine genes, which all of us get as a wonderful blessing from God. I then pointed out that the mental genes, which by the way are better known as vasanas, play a crucial role in deciding the way the person shapes. Another topic that I discussed in earlier lectures is the so-called PN cycle, where P stands for prasadam, or the gifts that God bestows on every individual, while N stands for naivedyam, or the offerings that we make to God. Okay, so we understand what P and N stand for, but what about the so-called PN cycle? Well, it means that in life we receive innumerable gifts from God, and that in turn implies that all these gifts must be used in such a manner that whatever we do becomes an offering to God. That's important. After discussing the PN cycle, I pointed out how the trusteeship concept makes the PN cycle automatic. By the way, trusteeship concept allows all members of society without distinction to simultaneously adopt the scheme. I also pointed out that the trusteeship concept is best understood by analyzing how the living human body works. Let me remind you what Swami says about the manner in which the different organs of the body work. Swami makes the following points. 1. The human body is a complex biological system made up of cells. 2. Cells make up the various organs of the body like eyes, stomach, liver, etc. 3. Many organs link to form together a system. Examples include the respiratory system, the digestive system, the circulatory system, and so on. 4. In a healthy human body, the systems do not function arbitrarily and in a disjointed manner. Rather, they work in perfect harmony and synergy. For example, when a person runs, the heart pumps faster and blood is circulated more rapidly to the muscles, especially of the leg. Similarly, after a heavy meal, blood circulation to the brain is reduced because more blood has to be diverted to the stomach to deal with digestion. In fact, that is why one tends to feel a bit sleepy after a heavy meal. 5. In short, it's a case of all for one and one for all. The cells work harmoniously through the organs and various systems to keep the body going. And the body, for its part, takes care of the organs and cells. It is this symbiosis that enables the body to be healthy. Now, all this becomes relevant in the context of how society ought to function. In days bygone, Swami often drew attention to this with the remark, "The proper study of mankind is man." In practical terms, it all boils down to the trusteeship principle. The trusteeship principle is based on the empirical and perhaps not accidental fact that society is a replica of the living human body. While the cell is the basic unit of the human body, in the case of humanity, it is the individual who plays the role of the basic unit. From there, if we proceed step by step and analyze carefully the two systems, namely the human body and humanity, we would see almost a one-to-one correspondence. I took you through all that earlier. What emerges in the end is that if selfish action forms the basis of life of every single individual, then society, which is just a macro replica of the individual, would be full of defects. It would not function well and make life for the individuals difficult and indeed miserable for many. That precisely is what is happening now. And the way out of it is for every single individual to say, "I am a servant of God. All the gifts God has mercifully bestowed on me, be it health or wealth or worldly knowledge or whatever, belong really to God. This body cannot claim any ownership. At best, I am a trustee acting for God and on behalf of God. And my duty is to use all the resources that God has placed at my disposal to serve humanity at large in the best possible manner. This I do by consciously loving all and serving all. All means not only all humans, but indeed all living creatures." That, in brief, is what the trusteeship principle is all about. And I hope the above recall would bring back to your mind all the details I gave earlier. It's time to wind up, and so let me start the closure formalities. I have said many things, but taken together, what do they mean? In brief, they tell us where individuals of today have to go. It's a roadmap, really. If every individual follows it meticulously, then he or she, as the case may be, would be actually following Mama Dharma, which is the theme of the companion Gita series of musings. But of course, hardly anyone is doing that, and when billions violate Mama Dharma, there sure can be trouble. Big trouble. As in fact we are finding out presently. The state of today's society can thus be summarized as follows. 1. The pressure for so-called material progress drives society towards complexity. 2. In turn, complexity generates more and more sectors. That is, it introduces diversity. 3. Each sector invariably has its own priorities, and the priorities of the different sectors often tend to clash. 4. As the number of sectors increase, the clashes become more pronounced. They even tend to get violent at times. 5. Even apex bodies like the UN, where all are supposed to come together for common good, get caught up in the conflict and rivalries between the different sectors or political groups. I hope I have said enough for you to appreciate that the time has come for each and every one of us to take Swami's teachings far more seriously than we do at present. No doubt we routinely say, help our hurt never, love all, serve all, and things like that. But do we pause to inquire what exactly they mean? What happens when we hurt others? What happens when we serve but with selfish ends, and so on? Do we ask such questions? Without a deeper understanding of what exactly Swami's teachings imply, our approach to devotion, seva, etc. would be utterly superficial. Swami's teachings are meant to make us better individuals, no doubt. But they are also intended to help us mesh better into a dharmic society. The important point about Swami's teachings at the present juncture is that we can no longer think of ourselves as individuals disconnected with society. Nor must we labor under the illusion that our obligations to society, if any, has nothing to do with God. It is precisely that disconnect that has landed us, that is to say humanity, in so much trouble at the present time. It's amazing how the Gita is packed in all these teachings as far back as 5,000 years ago. Countless scholars have commented on the Gita, but it's only Swami who has repeatedly drawn attention to its relevance to society and nature in the context of total devotion to God. You do not have to accept what I say, but please do spend some time thinking about it. Thank you for listening. Jai Sai Ram.
You have been listening to a talk by Professor G. Venkatraman in his musing series on awareness. Next week, his talk will deal with the Gita. This program came to you from the studios of Radio Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Tumhara rishta is dil se. दिल ही समझ पाएगा दूर होके भी तुमसे तुम्हारा एहसास करवाएगा पर आज तुम्हारी यादों में खोया किसी बात पर ये रूठा है ओ मां तुम बिन बेजुबा होने की शिकायत कर बैठा है बेजुबा होने की शिकायत कर बैठा है
धड़कन तुमा सांसों में बसती है तू मेरी माँ मेली पकड़ के चलना सिखलाया।
जीना है क्या इसका मतलब बतलाया। दूर न जाना कभी तुम,
तेरे बिना क्या दिन क्या रातें माँ, तुम आ जाओ ना।
तेरे बिना क्या दिन क्या रातें माँ, तुम आ जाओ।
We will keep thy holy light.
feel thy love.